Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio's infant mortality rates among African Americans is on par with some third world countries, and it ranks fourth in the nation overall, second in the nation among African American infants. The research comes from the Ohio State University Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. We'll hear from one of the lead researchers later on in the show. Joining us now is 89.7 NPR News reporter Mandy Trimble, who reported on the research this week. You can find her story at WOSU.org. Mandy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Anne.
Let's talk more closely about Columbus and where it stands in terms of infant mortality statistics. I compared Columbus or parts of Columbus, I think South Linden, to Guatemala. Mm-hmm. What other comparisons are there to give us a sense?
And I got this information from a government website, actually the CIA. They list all of the countries around the world and their infant mortality rates. So that's where this info comes from. But the Hilltop area, which has an infant mortality rate of 17 out of 1,000, that means 17 babies of every 1,000 born alive will die this year. The Hilltop compares to the Philippines. You've got the Near East side compares to El Salvador. The Near South side compares to the Gaza Strip. And South Linden, as you mentioned, has rates of Guatemala, and it's actually the highest infant mortality rate in Columbus, 23.5 of 1,000.
Were you shocked?
Oh, I was absolutely shocked. The story came about, I overheard a conversation, a journalist is always listening, that African-American women who are college-educated, who have good jobs and access to health care, still have a greater risk of their baby dying before their first birthdays compared to their white counterparts. And we all know that education and access to health care are two predictors of a pregnancy's outcome. So I was absolutely shocked to hear that, because if you have a good job and you're able to get health care, why do we have this disparity? So I started looking into that story, and then I stumbled across these statistics from partially from the Kerwin and doing a little more research, and I was absolutely astounded. And I think we all know that there is this gap among infant mortality rates between races, but I don't think any of us really knew how wide of a gap it was.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment about the infant mortality rates among African Americans in the city of Columbus and the state as a whole, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, all of these places that you mentioned, it's not like there's not a hospital nearby.
Right.
It's kind of surprising that Ohio ranks so badly anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It is shocking that Ohio is fourth in the nation and second among Black babies. I think that is astounding when you think about some other cities. We'll take Harlem, and we'll talk about Harlem a little mm-hmm. bit later. But Harlem's infant death rate is 7 compared to Franklin County, which, to get my numbers here, Columbus's total infant death rate is 9. So it is kind of shocking. But I think these neighborhoods that we're talking about, the 8 hotspots that the Kerwin Institute identified, the Southeast, South Linden, Northeast, Near South, Near East, the 161 Morse area, the Hilltop in Franklinton, all of those are some of the most impoverished neighborhoods in Columbus. So while there may be access to a hospital or access to a clinic, those moms may not have transportation to get there. They may not have the education to know, I need prenatal vitamins. They may not be received well when they get to those clinics, so they don't want to go back. There are so many different variables as to why this subset of women isn't seeking the prenatal care that they need.
There's an interesting quirk in among the Somali immigrant population, mm-hmm. where their rates are not anywhere near as bad off
right.
as this traditional African-American population.
Right. This was really interesting to me. The Morse Road area is a large Somali community, and their infant mortality rate is 11.7, which is one of the lowest of those 8 hotspots. And research shows that African-born women who come to the U.S. and have a baby have not great infant mortality rates, but they're not as high as African-American women. But after a generation, so those that, you know, Somali or Ghana or wherever, they come and they have their babies, their babies will have a greater chance of their child dying before their first birthdays. And researchers are saying that they are tracing that to not only poverty, but inherent racism.
And racism, tell us what they mean by inherent racism, what that...
Sure. So there's explicit racism. When you think about the KKK marching down the street, you know, screaming racial slurs. And then there's the inherent racism, which was explained to me that if you or I were to walk into a store and we walk around a boutique and we do our shopping, but then an African-American woman walks in and the clerk follows her around, or she walks into, you know, a health clinic seeking prenatal care, and she's not greeted kindly, or she's treated rudely. It's those kinds of ongoing throughout life, just the subtle nuances, that the differences between the way white women and black women are treated, that can affect a woman over time.
And it affects her baby, too.
It affects her baby. So
you can pass this on.
Right. And I think our guest in the future can talk a little bit more about that, the science behind that, because I'm clearly not a scientist. But it's all a stress. So if you are pregnant and you are under a lot of stress, whether it's poverty or other kinds of stressors, inherent racism creates a stressor. You go into a clinic, you don't feel like you're welcome there. It's stressful and you leave. That can cause, from what the way it's been explained to me, the fetus from not being able to get the nutrients it needs from the placenta, as you know, when that stressor is created. Also, it's been explained to me that over time, a woman who is under a significant amount of stress during her lifetime, that can also affect her gynecological health and can affect her uterus. So it's really astounding how much racism and stress can affect a woman's health.
We'll talk more about that later. In the meantime, if anyone has a question or comment, 614-292-8513. What you reported, as you mentioned earlier, on a Harlem program that really, it didn't eliminate a high mortality rate. There's still a high infant mortality rate there, but it significantly reduced it.
Significantly. It's called the Northern Manhattan Perinatal Partnership. And when this story came about, when it developed, the one that I reported on last week, it just so happened that the gentleman who is the CEO of that perinatal partnership was in town. So I was able to sit down with him. His name is Mario Drummonds, out of Manhattan. And about 20 years ago, he tried to start tackling this infant mortality rate in Harlem, which is a predominantly African-American community. And there are also, you know, women of other color, Hispanic. But their infant mortality rate about 20 years ago was 27. So 27, and just to, again, reiterate to our listeners what that means, is 27 out of every 1,000 babies born alive will die. He was able to, over 20 years, reduce that rate down to 7. And one thing that he, you know, said to me and underscored is that this is not an issue that is going to go away in a couple of years. He said, if our Columbus leaders and community leaders think that they're going to put a plan together and in 3 years we're going to have an infant mortality rate of, 6 in all of our communities, mm-hmm. it's not going to happen. But they did a lot. It's a little bit different in Harlem because they have a different kind of public transportation system than we do. So, but they started at, you know, at the bottom, getting fresh fruits and vegetables at the corner stores. That's something that an African American woman mentioned to me. She said, you know, we don't have you know, a grocery store in our neighborhood, and we've reported on that before, you know, the dearth of
the food desert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he said, you know, we started with that. We got local producers who could bring the produce into and have fresh fruits and vegetables at the corner stores. And it sounds simplistic, but, you know, they did little things like that over time. And another big thing they did was they increased the number of women that they could serve. So they had very few caseworkers. They increased it fivefold, which they were able to really bring in more women that they could serve, women, impoverished women, low-income women who needed those services.
So it took a pretty big investment then, because human resources are the most expensive.
Right. And they, this organization did a lot of fundraising. They didn't get all their money from the state. It was a public-private partnership. I know we hate to hear that term, but it was. And that's how they did it. But it was a lot of hard work. It was boots on the ground, knocking on doors. He said they looked at the statistics and looked at women who had miscarriages premature mm-hmm. babies, went to their home and said, here's where our clinics are. When you get pregnant again, here's where you need to go. And he said, we targeted those women so that it didn't, you know, they didn't have another reoccurrence.
What has the city of Columbus done in response to this kind of information?
Well, last year, Andrew Genther, president of Columbus City Council, created the Greater Columbus Infant Mortality Task Force. And I think they meet every month. I might be wrong about that. They meet every so often, and they bring in experts. You've got folks like folks from Columbus Public Health, different community leaders, folks from the school system I've seen at these meetings who come in. So they are trying to get as much information about the issue as they can to try to understand what's going on. The folks from Kerwin have presented at those meetings. So I think right now they're trying to get, you know, a game plan, if you will. How are we going to tackle this? So it's not like Columbus isn't doing anything. I think they're just trying to figure out how do we go about this? How do we fix it?
Coming up, we're going to hear from Jason Reese. He's the director of research for OSU's Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. And we'll also be hearing from an OSU pediatrics professor and founder of a program called Moms to Be to respond to this issue. For now, Mandy Trimble, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Mandy Trimble. She's 89.7 NPR News reporter. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, WOSU 89.7 NPR News reporter Mandy Trimble reported that Ohio's infant mortality rate ranks fourth overall in the nation. That is fourth worst in the nation. And among African-American babies, Ohio ranks second to Indiana, putting it on par with some third world countries. According to a new study by the Ohio State University's Kerwin Institute, Black infants in Ohio are twice as likely to die in their first year of life compared to white infants. Joining us now is the director of research for OSU's Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity, Jason Reese. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
How did you conduct this study? What were the metrics you were using?
We wanted to get a better understanding of the hot spots for infant mortality and really get a feel for what was going on in those communities, what assets were there, but also building upon what we know about some of the social determinants of health, really understanding what the conditions were in those communities that may be driving some of the disparate health outcomes that we see.
So it wasn't just numbers. It was more than that. How did you do that?
We looked at 5 years worth of infant death data and use that to create basically a hotspot map. what that map did after de-identifying a lot of the information for confidentiality purposes was to identify those zones where we were seeing, on average, more than 10 infant deaths per square mile. Those areas would then become our hot spots, and so we identified 8 of those throughout Franklin County, which Mandy spoke to earlier in the show today. Mm-hmm. And then we were able to look at what other things were going on in those communities, who lives in those communities, and if we think about kind of bringing down the infant mortality rate, what do those specific neighborhoods contribute to in terms of our overall infant mortality rate in the county?
Now, this isn't just a local problem. It's a nationwide problem. And I'm surprised to hear when you and I were talking before the show went on the air that the other hot spots nationally are all in Midwestern states.
Yes. In fact, traditionally, it's always been the Deep South for African-American infant mortality rates that has been some of the most challenging regions in the country. Mm-hmm. But actually, to steal a phrase from our colleague, Dr. Arthur James, who chairs the Infant Mortality Collaborative here in the state, what the Midwest is being referred to more recently, and particularly the Great Lakes states, is the New South. And what we see is a collection of states that are now filling out the bottom of the list, where we see Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio, all in the categories of the worst infant mortality rates for Black infants in the country.
What are the correlating trends, at least, that could help us understand this?
We're still trying to figure that out. One of the things that we look to is to really think about this relationship between place, community conditions, and health. And one of the things that all of these states share are that for communities of color, particularly the African-American community, there are high rates of residential segregation that usually translates to communities where environmental stressors are a lot higher. And it's also important to note that what we've seen with the recession is that the Black community was hit very hard in the Midwest and in many of these states in terms of unemployment and housing distress.
And has not recovered at the same rate as the rest of the population.
Absolutely. Yes.
Let's talk about the stressor of racism and what we talked briefly with Mandy Trimble about it. There's the explicit racism, and then there's inherent racism. It's more subtle, something you don't see or necessarily hear per se. What is it?
Well, you know, we often refer to that as implicit racism or implicit bias. And some of the research that's been growing in the last decade has really emphasized the role of implicit racism in influencing people's behaviors and the way they interact and treat other individuals who are different from them. And that could be different in terms of gender, class, race, body image. And what we've seen through countless studies is that everyone holds some degree of implicit associations, which may be negative. What we see nationally with the research here in the U.S. is that African Americans are generally at the receiving end of some of the worst negative connotations for implicit bias. And so to use the example that was given earlier, we could have an African American mother come into a clinic, and you may have an intake person there who's not necessarily inherently racist, but there are subtle things that are happening in which they are treating that particular mother differently, or they view that mother differently, or there are some inherent assumptions that they're making about that mother in regards to different dimensions of her lifestyle, or maybe even her potential to adhere to, say, medical treatment or therapy or something along those lines.
Once again, you're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Jason Reese. He's the director of research for OSU's Curwood Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. And we're talking about the high infant mortality rates among African Americans in Columbus and Ohio in the Midwest. If you have a question or a comment, you can join the conversation 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. London and Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, London.
Hi.
Tell us, you said you're the mother. Are you a mother?
Oh, no, I'm not a mother.
Okay, I was going to say, as soon as I heard your voice, I was like, Okay, tell us your story. What's up?
Yes, I just have a story. My mom had gone into a get a procedure. She needed to get an ultrasound done. And during the procedure, she had gone through a lot of pain. And, you know, she had told the nurse that she was going through pain. And the nurse didn't care. She said, it's fine, whatever, you know, it's not important. And it had caused my mom's bladder to drop. And it's just, you know, my mom, you know, when I think about this story, it just made me think, you know, what you were talking about earlier about the inherent racism. And I believe that, like the idea that you talked about before about, you know, a lot of these issues usually come in like poverty areas or areas where the uneducated are. And I think that, you know, that image, the poverty and uneducated, is an image that's projected on all Black people. You know, when the African Americans come in, they have the image of, oh, this person will be uneducated, or, you know, or they're going to have that. Well, my mom, what people will call my mom, is having like Black woman's rape. So it's like that is an inherent tension that's there when, you know, when women or Black women or African-American women or African-American people are getting procedures, that tension that, oh, this person is uneducated, oh, this person is going to have this poverty-stricken rage. And it's just, that's just something I want to comment on.
No, I think it's Jason, do you want to respond to what London said?
Yes, absolutely. And you know, sorry to hear about that. Story that your mother went through. What we've seen with the research around implicit bias, not just in the health domain, but in other domains like education, is that it's often these well referred to as gray areas, very subjective situations where we see biases start to kick in and we see kind of differential treatment in regards to the seriousness paid to maybe complaints in regards to a potential medical condition or in terms of what treatments are offered or tests are offered. And when we do think about this issue, there's a number of different interventions we have to think about. But one very important one is to understand the cultural competency of the medical profession, and also to help those working on this issue in the health professions make sure that they understand their own biases that may come into play and hopefully can change the way they maybe interact with particular patients.
The story that London described explains the stress you're talking about. It doesn't have to necessarily, you don't have to be poor.
Absolutely.
It's just being Black, and people associate and they have these implicit responses to that. And it explains the high infant mortality rate among even well-educated, middle-class African-American women.
Yes, absolutely. And that's another finding that really comes from the national research is that whereas, you know, we really see education and income as a great buffer for infant health risk, that effect isn't as strong for African-American women. And so while we certainly want to advocate for education and economic progress for those communities, it's important to note that that's not going to be enough.
London, thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. What the city recently formed a group called the Greater Columbus Infant Mortality Task Force. Their goal is to reduce infant mortality rates in Columbus by 40%. That seems like a lot. I don't have a time frame here, but do you have a sense about what realistic goals are and how you turn around these kinds of trends?
Yes, I do think the Northern Manhattan Perinatal Partnership that was described earlier.
Out of Harlem.
Out of Harlem, as well as the Be More for Better Babies campaign and some of these other campaigns that have been successful in dropping rates. I think those are very telling for anticipating what kind of declines in infant mortality we can see here in the community. It's very possible that in the short term that we can see a reduction. I don't necessarily know that we'll see a 40% reduction, but there is a lot of benefit to be had from just better aligning our resources, making sure that we're working within a collective impact model so that stakeholders across different domains are reaching these mothers and that we have supportive communities for these mothers. But in the long term, if we really want to go deep and if we really want to reduce those rates, we have to have this long-term approach that the Northern Manhattan Initiative has undertaken. And that means being really focused on the sustainability of our efforts and not necessarily letting ourselves get sidetracked by 2 and 3 year goals and really think in the long term.
Do we know what is what's killing the babies, why they're dying? Not necessarily the larger trends that affect their deaths, but is it, for instance, we have an email from a listener who asks whether you can comment on the number of babies that die each year from sleeping with adults. Mm-hmm. Programs like Put Babies Back to Sleep are supposed to cut down on SIDS, sudden yes. infant death syndrome, but many new mothers don't know that babies should sleep alone and on their back. So do we know what they're dying from, or are they just, is this just all sudden infant death syndrome?
We do know that that's certainly safe sleep issues does play a role, and that's some analysis that we're actually doing right now in terms of understanding where those deaths have occurred. But it's also important to note that a large number of deaths are complications related to preterm births, low birth weight births. So it's a fairly complex issue in regards to knowing that in some situations, definitely those educational campaigns regarding, say, safe sleep, I think can be an effective intervention. But again, it's not going to be a magic bullet that addresses all infant deaths.
Can you talk more about that stress that can be handed down through the generations? It's not necessarily that there's actually something physiological going on that's being handed down, not necessarily psychological.
Yes. Yeah, so what we're starting to see from the field of epigenetics is that,
which
really is the study of generational changes that can occur to DNA, which then results into health challenges, is that there certainly is an intergenerational effect. And I think the research is still trying to understand that effect right now. Some of the first research that I became aware of in this, the field of epigenetics really looked at the descendants of folks who survived kind of wartime atrocities and great traumatic events like that. And surprisingly, even though we had aid and other resources for these folks and the next generation of children that came out of these families, we saw health impacts there that really shouldn't have been there, given the resources that were there. So that really keyed in researchers that there was something going on at cellular level or changes to DNA itself that is actually kind of predisposing folks to health risks in that next generation. So we have to think about that in regards to some of these racial disparities that we see in our communities. We're just 40 years removed from the Civil Rights Act, 50 years removed from the Civil Rights Act. Mm-hmm. We still have certainly great issues that we're dealing with today, but many of the policies that were outright discriminatory were still active in the generation preceding us in terms of impacting their life and being a stressor within their lifespan.
And even after the Civil Rights Act, there were still overt
Absolutely.
People were living in among overt racist
Absolutely.
Groups.
Yes, yes.
If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. What recommendations has the Kerwin Institute made to combat this problem specifically?
We see a number of interventions being very important. First, focusing on this issue of cultural competency, of making sure that the research regarding implicit bias in healthcare is well known and is appreciated in the healthcare industry.
A lot of times we're talking about someone like a technician,
yes.
not the physician.
Exactly, exactly. We also note that this place-based analysis that we've done and these place-based practices from Baltimore or from Harlem should be really telling for what type of interventions we should look at in our community here. There are certainly those neighborhoods which are hotspots, which have significant assets. And one of the things that we really have to think about is how can we align our interventions so we're building upon those assets in those communities. For example, in many of the neighborhoods that are hotspots, we actually have some very robust community development efforts going on right now. But is the public health sector connected into those efforts? Are we making sure that our mothers at risk are the folks who are first in line, for example, to benefit from, say, new housing redevelopment that's going on, transportation improvements? And so this coordination could pay significant dividends in terms of making sure that our resources are aligned. And this is one point I'm very optimistic about here in Franklin County in Ohio. We have significant assets and significant resources in regards, particularly in regards to our health institutions. And so hopefully through better alignment, through adopting collective impact models to kind of crossing those different barriers of discipline and domain so that folks working in community development and education and health are working together in these neighborhoods, I think we could see some significant progress in the long term.
Ann in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Ann.
Yes, hi. I'm listening to what the professor saying, and he did mention with different groups that do come in the country, they tend to do better
at first.
At first, and I'm wondering if it would be helpful, since a lot of the groups, like I know they're Hispanic, you usually have Hispanic interpreters, Hispanic doctors, you know, there to help them through their transitions. Perhaps we need to have African American doctors, nursing, and social workers, and people around that they relate to.
Is there a sense about how the Jason Reese, how the medical community stacks up proportionately when it comes to race?
Yes, it's actually very troubling. A statistic that was shared to us by the Association of American Medical Colleges indicated that actually we have fewer African-American students, African-American male students in medical school today than we did in the late 1970s. Very shocking to hear those figures. We have a very significant underrepresentation of African-Americans in the medical industry, particularly among physicians or other folks who are working directly with patients on a one-on-one basis. And so we have to think of this also as a pipeline issue. We need to make sure that we have a more representative workforce in regards to the healthcare industry if we're really going to be reflective of the diverse community that we all live and work within.
Ann, thanks a lot for that call. And real quickly, Darnell in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Darnell.
Joseph is the name.
I'm sorry.
Damrell.
Okay.
Curious about the use of the term implicit and also the term inherent when we talk about racism. As a sociologist, the term that we use is institutional, because I think that is the same, has the same connotations, and that is that racism has been so deeply embedded in institutions and in the arrangements among institutions that the individuals or groups within those institutions don't need to be overtly racist to carry out racist policies or to have an effect that is basically racist. And I'm wondering about that use of the vocabulary here and about if we're not sort of moving away from this concept of institutional racism, which I think is a very significant and powerful concept.
Thank you, Joseph, for that call. Thanks. Is institutional racism, as Joseph describes it, a subset of either the implicit or inherent?
Yes, it's definitely related, and you know, I certainly don't want to downplay the role of institutional discrimination in the way that policies and practices can be very punitive to particular communities or communities of color. One of the things that we do want to focus on when we talk about implicit racism or implicit bias is that this is absolutely a phenomena that's occurring in which there really is no racist intent operating at a conscious level. One of the challenges I think that many of us have when kind of conceptualizing things like institutional racism is that we kind of imagine a room of leaders, you know, very nefarious folks, let's say a bunch of Donald Sterlings deciding that this institution's not going to serve this community as well as it should. The reason we focus so much on talking about implicit association and implicit bias is that these are often very well-meaning folks who are often very egalitarian, but like all of us, we all have our implicit biases that come out in certain situations. And so the best way to deal with that is through education and through working to help identify those biases so that actually impacts our behaviors in the future as individuals.
Joseph, thanks for that call. Jason Reese of OSU's Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity will stay with us and joining us when we return. Dr. Pat Gabby, she's an OSU pediatrics professor and founder of the program Moms to Be. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. In Ohio, black infants are twice as likely to die in their first year of life compared to white infants. Locally, one group is working with expectant mothers to change that scenario. Joining us now is OSU pediatrics professor and founder of the program Moms to Be, Dr. Pat Gabby. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
How does the Moms to Be program approach the issue of infant mortality differently?
Well, we do it differently. First of all, we welcome every pregnant mom. We want our pregnant moms in Ohio, and especially in the hotspots that Jason mentioned, to come in and feel like their pregnancy is incredibly valuable to our community. So we make it a festive occasion. We want to know their name when they walk in. We want to say, hello, we're so happy you're here. How can we help you? Join our group. We're here to offer group support, community support. We have fun. We eat a healthy meal together. We talk about all the issues that can help them have a healthy pregnancy.
And you do it in a really positive manner. And Jason Reese, your research has shown that this matters. It sounds sort of trivial when you talk about having fun, but it matters.
Absolutely. One of the things that Pat's program really does a tremendous job at is actually building social capital for these mothers who are very isolated. Mm-hmm. We often forget that these mothers otherwise might be in situations where they're going to go to the hospital and deliver by themselves, not having that social support there. And we've at the Institute have been a great admirers of Pat's program because it's been so effective in building that supportive community around these mothers.
Pat?
Yes. I mean, we have 10 to 15 moms pregnant. And then what we've learned is these moms come back, which we are so grateful for. We want them to be proud of that baby. So they come back, they show us the baby, and then they stay with us. So we've evolved from a pregnancy support group to pregnancy and parenting support because we know that first year of life is so important for that baby also. So again, they're connecting with each other as well as with us. I love them. I call them my moms. And I don't want them to graduate. So we've had some moms who've been there for 4 years. And we help them find jobs, get into the community, and get into the workforce if that's what they want to do. But as Jason said earlier, this is a community issue. And we try to have a holistic approach. And you mentioned also one of the barriers our mom has is transportation. Mm-hmm. Transportation to get good food, transportation to a job, transportation to take their children for childcare. So all kinds of issues that we need the whole community behind us to change this trajectory.
We have an email from Sharon. She writes, has there been any consideration of involving the birth community and engaging them to help brainstorm ideas that could help lower the infant mortality rate? There is an entire community of childbirth educators, doulas, midwives, and more who would love to help create solutions. Is that part of your equation?
Of course. We love the midwives. We have two OSU midwives. One comes to our Wineland Park, our Grace Missionary Baptist Church. session every week, and one comes to our OSU East Wallace Auditorium session every week. So they're part of our teaching, our education, and they connect with the mom when the mom goes into labor or goes to the clinic for prenatal care. So absolutely, they're a very important part of the equation.
This has to change what your mom's expectations are going forward. This is how we're supposed to be treated? Oh, okay.
Yes, and you may have heard Mandy Trimble interview some of our moms last week.
Yeah, I'm sorry we couldn't get any of them on the show.
And one of them clearly said, you know, having this education that we, and empowerment really that we do at our moms-to-be sessions, that helps us when we go to the doctor, when we go to the clinic. We know what to ask for. We know our numbers. One of our inspirational leaders, Tanika Price, taught us that we need to teach our moms what is the right blood pressure, what is the right blood sugar, what is the right hemoglobin, because we know that African-American women are significantly adversely affected because they have more hypertension, anemia, asthma. So these physical conditions, unfortunately, disproportionately affect pregnant African-American women. So,
Carl in the North Columbus, hi.
Hi. I'm again hearing an absence of half of the equation, the hit-and-run fathers. For instance, up as an example, up in Mount Rainier, some people put themselves out on a mountain and fell down 3,000 feet. They put themselves in a dangerous position by choice. Now, I'm hearing your program presenters blame society for the problem that these women have gotten themselves into with the help of what I call hit-and-run fathers.
Well, we mentioned the absence of social capital. I think that's partly what we were talking about, Pat Gabby.
Oh, well, I'm not exactly sure what the caller was requesting.
I mean, we were talking about some women, Jason Reese, going into, to give birth sometimes by themselves, that kind of a thing.
Well, we do need more involvement with fathers. Mm-hmm. It's a critical missing ingredient for some of our moms, but it's really unfair to blame the women. I just find them so resilient, and once they have some support and are educated, they want to have a healthy pregnancy. They want to have a healthy baby.
And I think it's important to know, and I'm certainly very supportive of trying to get more fathers engaged, and we definitely need more fathers engaged in these communities that are facing these challenges. But the situation in these communities can be very difficult. One of the things that comes out of the research is that there is a direct relationship between the incarceration rate in a neighborhood and the rate of infant mortality. And some folks may say, these are folks who are up to no good.
They broke a law.
Right. When you start to look at that data, most of these folks are incarcerated for nonviolent drug offenses. Many of which are doing that as part of the informal economy in these neighborhoods because, as we all know, the economy has collapsed in many of these communities and the job opportunities that were there 20, 30, 40 years ago are gone today. And so while certainly that's problematic, it's important to note, we can't talk about fathers without opening up this bigger picture of what's happening to particularly young Black men who maybe are victimized by crime or caught up in the apparatus of the criminal justice system.
I think another issue, Anne, is that we see this as a cycle. So if a mom has a premature baby, let's say a baby's born at 30 weeks gestation, that baby may have learning disabilities later on. That baby may have behavior issues later on. That baby may not be successful even in kindergarten, first grade. So that sets that child up for more difficulties in society, more difficulties getting a job. So unless we break this cycle and we help these moms have healthy full-term babies, we'll always be chasing this and wondering why we're having trouble with schools, why we're having trouble with poverty, why we're having trouble with crime.
And an email from Vivian, I think, brings this up. She says one other issue which could be addressed while discussing prenatal care for moms is the health and outcome for babies who don't die, but who have cognitive and or educational problems and long-term health care concerns as a result of inadequate prenatal care and nutrition, which I think it's the inadequacies that are what we're trying to understand and address better. What are those inadequacies? It's not necessarily not getting your prenatal pills, but maybe how someone treats you every time you go into the clinic to get them.
Right.
Well, we have had barriers because if mom doesn't have an insurance card, for example, it's been an enormous barrier to getting in the first trimester when we want all women to come, where they can get the most help.
Because Medicaid didn't,
so
for
Medicaid,
single people, right.
Right. We've had a good Medicaid system if you're pregnant. But you had to prove you were pregnant before you could oftentimes get that Medicaid card. Now with expansion of Medicaid and the ACA, all of our moms should have better access and be able to get in early.
Chris in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hello. How are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Good, good. Yes, I'm listening to your program and just want you to know I'm enjoying it immensely.
Thank you.
Very good subject, and just great information that you're putting out there. My question was, listening to Pat and the services that she provides for the Moms to Be program, it sounds very interesting. It sounds like these are great services that help these moms that are in need. And I was wondering, is she collaborating or is she networking in any way with health and medical professionals? Because it sounds like the services that she's providing, it sounded very compassionate. Sound like she's very sensitive to the needs of the moms. And I think this is one of the problems when these moms go into the hospitals and the clinics, as has already been mentioned, that sometimes these medical professionals are not cultural and racial sensitive to some of the background experiences that some of these mothers, African-American mothers, have come from.
Well, I should be calling her Dr. Gabby. She's an OSU pediatrics professor. But let's talk about that and how, are you conveying what you're learning, Dr. Gabby, to the medical field in general?
Well, it's an absolute fabulous question. Mm-hmm. And yes, we are. One of our, some of our program support comes from a state program to educate health professionals on how to serve and meet women in poverty, families in poverty. So we have, we graduated about 50 professional, healthcare professional students.
Okay.
They come to Moms to Be every week. They learn, they're physician students, medical students, medical dietitian students, social work students. We have a big program to help educate. We also have had reception from our labor and delivery nurses at OSU to come to Moms to Be. And they make an extra point of welcoming a mom to be when she comes into labor, when she wants to breastfeed. So we have taken some steps. We need to do a lot more.
What about what Jason Reese was talking about earlier about the numbers of African-American and people of color in the healthcare industry?
Well, we're trying to do our best, and we welcome any young African-American woman or man who wants to go into the health profession fields. There are so many opportunities, and we need more of you.
Okay. Chris, thanks for that call. And real quick, Candace, we only have about 30 seconds. Hi, Candace.
Hi. First, thank you guys for the program and providing all this information and insight. I just wanted to point out one of the callers, I think it was Carl from North Columbus, made a comment that kind of illustrates the whole racism issue. The assumption he made was that all of these women are coming and they don't have the fathers of their babies involved, and that's just not necessarily the case. Could you address that point?
Okay, Candace, thanks a lot. Jason Reese?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a great example of one of the assumptions that we run into, which can be very negative. It's really important to note when we looked at some of the data, a number of these mothers are really young. The fathers are really young. They're not in an ideal situation in terms of their life circumstances or where they're at in their life to actually be having a baby at this time. So that speaks to things like family planning and the need for contraception. But I think it is a pretty powerful example of the type of biases that kick in when we start to touch upon these sensitive issues around race and racial discrimination.
We have a number of fathers that come to Moms-to-Be, and okay. We welcome them. And there's a group prenatal program in Columbus now centering pregnancy at Nationwide Children's and at OSU. They welcome fathers.
Okay.
It's part of the program. So, you know, the more we welcome, the more they will come.
Dr. Pat Gabby, thanks for joining us. And also Jason Reese of the Kerwin Institute, Pat Gabby of the program Moms-to-Be, and thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.